First, I'd like to say it's a great pleasure and honor to have been asked to deliver the second in a series of public lectures organized by Dr. Fuo Cooper of the James Robinson Chair of Black Canadian Studies. Words cannot express the high esteem and respect I have for Fuo and the energy, dynamism, scholarship, and community involvement, sort of the quintessential elements of being an organic intellectual, which so many of us strive to be and admire. And I think Fuo represents all of that. So it's really, truly a great pleasure and honor not only to have been asked to do the second lecture, but also to consider myself a very close friend of Fuo. So thank you, Dr. Cooper. And as some of you know, the JRJ Chair, the James Robinson Johnson Chair, is a very important institution for black communities across Canada, as it seeks to redress within the halls of the Academy the continuing depredations of racism, inequality, and disenfranchisement while celebrating the self-conscious activity of people of African descent in this country as they assert their right to self-determination, justice, and human dignity. While its focus is on Canada, the chair places the Canadian experience within the international context of the African diaspora, the immense worldwide community of people of African descent. That is why it's such a great pleasure and honor to deliver the lecture, Race and Revolution, Lessons from Cuba. As many of you know, Cuba is one of my passions, a main focus of my scholarly work and political activism. With the triumph of the Cuban Revolution on January 1st, 1959, this Caribbean island has occupied a position in the African diaspora unrivaled, except perhaps by the Haitian Revolution, for the profundity and meaning of its revolutionary experience. And also, I owe a great deal personally, in terms of my career, to the Cuban Revolution, in a sense that in the back you have Errol Sharp of Fulmer Publishing. He has a copies of my book and other things on Cuba. And I can actually say my life can be talked about before I published that book, or before the book was published and after the book was published. Before the book, I was a nobody, in a sense. After the book, and I actually wondered did I write a piece of garbage? And I was very worried. And it was received so well, I'm surprised at how many universities picked it up and the kind of reviews it got and so forth. And so it sort of made me recognize, and I always like to use this term very gently, because even though I've been to Cuba over 40 times, I don't think I really truly understand the Cuban reality as such, but as a so-called Cuba specialist. So I owe a lot of thanks to Errol Sharp, who decided to publish this, because it was based on a monograph was a paper that was delivered at the International Development Studies Speaker Series at St. Mary's, and Errol decided it was worthwhile to develop into a book, and I did that, so I owe a lot of thanks and gratitude to Errol Sharp, and I hope you do patronize that table in the back there and buy some books. Okay? Now, on January 25th, Rocky Jones, the esteemed Rocky Jones, Dr. Bernie Jones, who was here, an icon and exemplar, treated us to an engrossing and gripping lecture. During his magisterial presentation, he mentioned the impact the Cuban Revolution had on many of the black activists during the civil rights movement, particularly as the movement radicalized in the latter half of the 1960s with the emergence of the Black Power movement and several black revolutionary organizations, most notably the Black Panther Party. In this lecture, I will address why the Cuban Revolution has exercised such a profound hold and influence on the worldwide black struggle for equality, freedom, and self-determination, and whether the Cuban Revolution has any meaning and relevance for present-day struggles and imaginings of a world centered on social justice, human dignity, and general emancipation. A central concern for many of us, as we look at what's unfolding on the world scale, this will be something I'm sure that will be taken up by Dr. Hakim Adi when it comes to address what some people are referring as a new scramble for Africa, the new redivision of what was once referred to as a magnificent African cake. And all of us living in Canada in this present political environment have very serious concerns about what Canada would look like years from now. Now, I've divided the main body of my lecture into five parts. First, I will illustrate the dramatic impact that the Cuban Revolution had on black radicals in the 1960s and 70s, and the continuing influence and legion it continues to enjoy among black progressive circles. Second, before we can discuss the Cuban Revolution, it is necessary to provide a historical background. So I'll provide what will perhaps be a whirlwind tour of Cuban history before the advent of the revolution in 1959, especially as it relates to black Cubans, and I will highlight key events, developments, and personalities. It will indeed be a whirlwind tour. But I don't think you can appreciate the Cuban Revolution, and also within that, the experience of people of African descent in Cuba, unless you place it in the historical context. And I actually hope I have it here. I recommend anyone who wishes to really understand how Cuba fits in to the how the Cuban Revolution fits into Cuban history as a whole, I highly recommend Luis Perez's Cuba Between Reform and Revolution, which situates the Cuban Revolution as being an organic extension in many ways of what happened before 1959. The Cuban Revolution, you can make an argument, is not simply some alien grafting on to Cuban history, but represents an almost inevitable and logical extension of what unfolded before 1959. Third, I will discuss the impact on black Cubans of the first 30 years of the Cuban Revolution, from the triumph of the revolution in 1959 to the beginning of the disintegration of the Soviet Union and the East Bloc in 1989. What is often referred to, and I would argue incorrectly, as the collapse of socialism or so-called socialism. It was a collapse of a series of countries that practiced what we may call socialism or so-called socialism, but the idea of socialism still seems to have some life and viability, despite what some people on the right might think. Fourth, I will then discuss developments after 1989, which encompasses the unprecedented economic crisis that gripped Cuba, ushering in the so-called special period in a time of peace. The special period tested the Cuban Revolution's resilience and viability, resulting in the introduction and implementation of economic policies that had a dramatic impact on Cuban society. Finally, I will discuss what relevance does the more than 53-year experience of the Cuban Revolution have for contemporary struggles for racial inequality in the African diaspora. Before I proceed, I need to clarify a couple of things. First, the focus of my lecture is on the experience of black Cubans within the Cuban Revolution. While other ethnic groups and nationalities, for example, Chinese and Arabs, comprise Cuba, blacks, I would argue, are born, and I think this is almost a truism, the burden of racism, discrimination, and social inequality. Also, I do not mean to imply that black Cubans represent a monolithic bloc. There are black Cubans, for example, whose origins lie in Haiti and are very active in proudly celebrating the Haitian roots and culture, and there's quite an active society that focuses on this as well. Of course, this raises the question of how does one define who is black in general and who is black in Cuba in particular. Despite the assertion of the vast majority of biologists that there is no biological reality to race, the concept and belief continues to bedevil and dominate us, inherent at all levels of the state and society. I would argue that the vast amount of historical research quite persuasively demonstrates that race is a social and historical construction. However, calling race a social and historical construction does not deny that it is very real in its consequences. Race as a human creation springing from very particular historical contexts and interactions of social forces has come in many ways to rule over us and profoundly affect masses of people as if it was real. In some ways, race is clearly real. And if you're black living in this society, we know who is black and we know race is real. I mean, it may be difficult at sometimes to have that precise definition, but for those of us living it, we understand what race means. That does not take away from the fact that there are particular historical and social forces and contexts that led to its creation and generation. So while it has no biological or concrete materiality, the idea of belief has seized people's minds and thus become a material force in society. Now, one of the things that's important to understand is that this is often tied up with identity. You know, for example, who is defined as black, who is considered black, who might identify as black, changes from time and geographical space. So many people who are considered black in North America might not be considered black in a Caribbean context or in an African context. And I've, you know, having grown up in the Caribbean, having been in Africa a couple of times, particularly in South Africa, I've experienced this as well. And what's interesting, and I don't want to oversimplify things, in North America, we probably adopt the dominant thing is the one-drop thesis, right. one-drop theory. One drop of black blood makes you black, okay? And one of the things I found in the Caribbean, and we can carry this on a discussion, is sometimes people quite sadly hope that one drop of white blood makes them white. And we can talk about some of this pigmentocracy that's arisen and so forth. I actually have a student who's actually writing on the many, for example, in Brazil, there's over 50, 60, over 100 different official designations of skin color. Okay, and so forth, of gradations in society. And we can talk a little bit about this as well. I don't want to delve into that, because at the same time, they say that maybe 60, 70, 75% of Cuban population, there's a big debate, can claim African descent. That does not mean they identify as black, because they have other sorts of these descents running through their history and so forth. That's one thing. And we can get it, because there's a whole debate over what portion of the Cuban population is black or not, and that in essence tends to shine some light on what's unfolding in Cuba. I should also emphasize, because people have heard me talk about this so often, that this talk will not cover Cuba's role in the struggle against racist apartheid state, except in passing. From 1975 to 1991, more than 300,000 Cubans served in Angola defending that country from repeated South African attacks. And more than 2,000 died in Angola fighting that racist state. I won't get into that whole discussion here because my talk is not about that. It's about the domestic reality of race in Cuba. But I did bring my PhD dissertation along in case anybody wanted to carry on into that discussion, right? Okay? It's been something I've spoken about for quite a while, right? Okay? But at the same time, I don't want to actually engage in that discussion here because that will take us a little farther afield. I might make some brief comments on it in a sense, because when Cuba got involved, it was actively engaging with this debate and this nature of the dynamic of race within Cuban society. Okay? Though I might add, okay, before I proceed, I thought this was useful to add, if I can get this going, that, okay, this is Cuba, that I might add that it was my understanding of this battle in Quito Carnaval and what happened in Cuba that led to my only meeting with Fidel, which was, I actually met him for 15, 20 minutes. I actually had a camera in my pocket at the time, okay? This dude was so dumbfounded, that I never even took the photo. And the only photo that remains of the meeting is we met for 15 minutes, because I was known as El Canadiense, because we can talk about it. I made a comment at a conference about Quito Carnaval. I was taken by this gentleman here, if I can find him, that right here, who was one of the organizers of the conference, to meet Fidel because of the comment I made, and all I remember is being dumbfounded, and then the only picture that remains of that is a picture taken by an official photographer, right? Who took this photo looking at me completely mesmerized. Okay? The 15-minute meeting is lost. I didn't take any photos out. And then the next day, this guy comes up to me and says, here's a photo, right? So that's one thing I just wanted to do. Okay? So, first of all, I want to get into this impact of Cuba on African Americans. The Cuban Revolution had a profound influence on black activists, radicals, almost from its inception. Memories of Fidel Castro's September 1960 visit to Harlem and his meeting with Malcolm X are firmly ensconced in that community's myth and legend. Here's a report of Fidel meeting with Malcolm X. Okay? Castro had arrived in New York to attend the 15th session of the United Nations General Assembly. After facing exorbitant demands from the Shelburne Hotel, where Cuban envoys normally stayed, they demanded an incredible deposit be paid before they allowed the Cuban diplomats to stay. Black activists in the Fair Play for Cuba Committee organized for the Cuban delegation to move to the Hotel Teresa in Harlem. In Harlem, despite pouring rain, Castro and his court were greeted by a rally of 2,000, more than 2,000 African and Hispanic Americans. One participant held up a sign, U.S. Jim Crow's Fidel, just like U.S. Jim Crow's Negroes in the U.S. And I hope I'm not in the way. So that's Fidel and Malcolm. This is legendary. There's a very good book written on this. Here's Fidel Castro. This is a crowd. People like Nasser. Here's Abdel Gamal Nasser, who was then the nationalist president of Egypt, coming to visit him. A lot of people came to visit him. And so this sojourn of Fidel in Harlem has become part of the legend and mythos of Harlem itself. So groups of black intellectuals and activists began visiting Cuba in the 1960s. Robin Kelly, in his landmark book, Freedom Dreams, A Black Radical Imagination, I recommend this book to everyone, okay, noted that once they had traveled, that once these black activists and radicals had traveled to Cuba, they returned, quote unquote, transformed. The famous Amir Baraka, then known as Leroy Jones, we seem to have a lot of Jones who are poets, we have two of them in the audience here, stated in his 1984 autobiography, that after his trip to Cuba, quote, I carried so much back with me that I was never the same again. The dynamic of the revolution had touched me. Baraka later published an important essay called Cuba Libre, Free Cuba, that extolled the Cuban Revolution. It's a very important essay. He talked about it. And in it, he made a transition from being a black nationalist to eventually becoming an avowed Marxist-Leninist and so forth. And his experience in the Cuban Revolution was very important upon this. Upon his return from Cuba, Robert Williams, who I'll return to later, who had organized armed self-defense groups to defend blacks from the terrorism of the Ku Klux Klan, flew a Cuban flag in his yard. He then wrote a series of articles about the ongoing socioeconomic changes in Cuba, arguing that the African-American struggle was related to the revolutionary transformations that were unfolding in Cuba. In a 1960 article, Williams declared, that the Cuban Revolution and the African-American struggle were intimately entwined. Okay? These views were reflected by other black activists and intellectuals. Journalist William Worthy explicitly tied together African-American liberation and the Cuban Revolution's efforts to resist U.S. imperialism. Quote, "The struggle of 18 million Negroes for equality and justice in the United States will have little meaning if 90 miles south of our border, 6 million Cubans, that was the population of Cuba at that time, are denied the freedom to run their country according to the 20th century concepts of true independence and to set a beacon of for the rest of the exploited countries of Latin America." Julian Mayfield, another black journalist, wrote, quote, "The colored American should take a close look at the Cuban Revolution. On a recent visit to the island, I saw proof that it doesn't take decades of gentle persuasion to deal a death blow to white supremacy. Before the revolution, the position of colored people in Cuban society was roughly similar to that of colored people in our border states, i.e. meaning the southern states. The important lesson in the Cuban experience is that great social change does not have to wait on the patient education of white supremacists." I think something we all agree about. They should not be patiently educated, but that's another issue. These are but a few examples of the influence the Cuban Revolution had on black activists and radicals. Harold Cruz, and I'll pull him up here. Okay, Harold Cruz, who was an ex-communist and basically worked with a lot of these black radicals. Okay. Noted that Fidel Castro, argued that Fidel Castro had joined the pantheon of modern heroes for black America. This pantheon included, according to Cruz, the African independence leaders Kwame Nkrumah from Ghana and Patrice Lumumba from the Congo. According to Cruz, Fidel Castro, along with Nkrumah and Lumumba and others, seemed heroic to African Americans because, quote, not because of their political philosophy, but because they were either former colonials who achieved complete independence, or because, like Malcolm X, they dared to look the white community in the face and say, we don't think your civilization is worth the effort of any black man to integrate into. This, to many Afro-Americans, is an act of defiance and is truly revolutionary. End of quote. Now, I usually talk very fast. I'm trying to read this very slowly, right? As I'm stumbling over these things. Somebody said, this early fascination, support, and identification with the revolution did not diminish. For example, Huey Newton, co-founder and leader of the Black Panther Party, credited the Cuban Revolution, along with the Chinese Revolution and other developments. And in fact, Eldridge Cleaver actually became an expert or became an advocate of what was unfolding under Kim Il-sung in North Korea. But the Cuban Revolution was a key formative event for many of these black radicals, right? And Huey Newton credited as one of the key influences for the development of his revolutionary thought, particularly his engagement in Marxism-Leninism. The fascination and support did not end in the 1960s. It continued in the 1970s, 80s, up to the present. Key organizers of the first Vence Ramos Brigade to Cuba were black activists. Now, I'm jumping over a lot of history here, but the Vence Ramos Brigades have been going for over 40 years to Cuba, and they were designed specifically to introduce Americans to what was unfolding in Cuba. And I remember interviewing Phil Hutchings, who was the last chairperson of SNCC, which was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, became the Student National Coordinating Committee. And he talked about that he and other black activists were the key organizers in getting the Vence Ramos Brigades organized in the 1970s. And they continue to be extremely active. What's interesting as well is even in solidarity movements in the United States and with Cuba, like, for example, the National Network on Cuba, African Americans continue to play very important roles. Even the Nation of Islam, and I'm going to, yes, Afarakan, okay. Even the Nation of Islam supported the Cuban Revolution with its national publications regularly publishing articles in Cuba that condemned the aggressive U.S. policy towards the island. And El, you don't have to, I can read actually from here. You don't need to turn the lights down.
Okay, I can see
the computer. Okay, so here is Louis Farrakhan. Actually, I took this photo. There's Louis meeting with Fidel. And there's lots of articles that would appear in the final call, right? And you would be some of people would be a little surprised that the Final Call or the Nation of Islam has such a profound relationship or support for the Cuban Revolution. And Farrakhan has actually received medical attention there. Here is Jesse Jackson on one of his visits to Cuba. I think this is from 1984. He actually delivered a sermon at a church that Fidel attended. Okay. Here is the Reverend Al Sharpton. I actually took that photo. I was surprised that he was not of the considerable girth that I thought he would be. This is at a conference in 2000. This is at a conference in 2000, right? Yes. And even BET, okay? And also what's interesting as well is that Harlem in 94 and 2000, Fidel Castro was accorded a rapturous welcome in Harlem, okay? And this is from 95, I think the strippers, 94, 95. This is, that's Rangel in the back, you know, he's no longer in Congress. And it was an packed crowd that took place. In 2000, he gave another one at Riverside Church. This is at the Abyssinian Baptist Church. He also gave one in 2000 at the Riverside Church. And the support of the African-American community was tremendous. They even had an ad hoc committee called Africans in the Americas to welcome Fidel Castro. Even Black Entertainment TV, BET, organized a visit of African-American intellectuals to Cuba. And when Tavis Smiley used to work with them, this is actually from his website, from her client, Tavis Smiley, meeting with Fidel Castro. I actually have that BET meeting with Fidel on tape as well. So there's this fascination about Cuba, and we'll get a little bit into that as well. Today's support for an identification with the Cuban Revolution, as I noted, is one of the main characteristics of the vast majority of Pan-Africanist organizations and other Black organizations that still promote and work for the radical transformation of society. The African All African People's Revolutionary Party, which was organized by Stokely Carmichael, now by Kwame Ture, formerly Stokely Carmichael. There's a whole series of them as well. And as I said before, African Americans continue to play very prominent roles in the Cuba Solidarity Movement and so forth. I don't need the light off. I don't need the light on. The light can stay off. I can see. Yeah, I can see perfectly. Yeah. Okay. Okay. For example, because I've got the light. So that's one thing. For example, the All African People's Revolutionary Party, as I said, is very active in Cuba solidarity work. Okay. Oh, you need the light. Sorry. So put the light back on if you draw for needs the light. I apologize. Okay? So its late leader and founder Kwame Ture, and I highly recommend his autobiography, Ready for Revolution. Kwame Ture, formerly known as Stokely Carmichael, once described Fidel Castro, and I quote, as the blackest man in the Americas, right? And and no one can deny that Stokely Carmichael was one of the greatest proponents, right, and advocates of African-American struggle, of the necessity to center African-Americans in their Africanness, right? So Stokely Carmichael, but he was also very political, and he considered Cuba to be extremely important. And he put politics first, and Fidel Castro was seen as fitting into his brand of politics. And I actually spoke with Kwame Ture about a month or so before he died, right? And we had a discussion about this and so forth, about the importance of the revolutionary movements in the South, but particularly that of Cuba. Now, the support and identification with the Cuban Revolution by North American radicals was the product of, one, the perception that a fundamental and radical social transformation had taken place in Cuba, and the status of Black Cubans had dramatically improved, and two, Cuba's direct assistance to African national liberation movements, especially in the fight against the racist South African state. This is a picture. I will not be covering this in detail, but this is from 1991. The first country that Nelson Mandela chose to visit outside of Africa was Cuba. And also important to understand is this. There's two things. Is that when one looks at when Nelson Mandela's inauguration as president in 1994 was taking place, only one person traveled with him in his car to the inauguration. That was Fidel Castro. And at the end of the inauguration, when he had sworn in as president, and you can actually see it in the different network feeds. You know, he's meeting with the dignitaries, they're coming forward and so forth. And when Fidel Castro comes up, he jumps out and he gives him a hug and he says very audibly, you made today possible and so forth. And we can chat about that as well and so on. And I'll get into it because one of the things that Cuba did when it got involved in Africa was at one point Fidel described Cuba as an African Latin country. And he talked very much about the debt that Cuba owed because of slavery, and that we had to go there to actually participate in that particular struggle. But it should also should be noted that Cuba also served as a refuge for many Black radicals who were forced into exile. And here we come back to Robert Williams, organized one of the deacons for self-defense, armed groups fighting against Ku Klux terrorism in the U.S. South. Trumped up charges, had to flee from the United States, was eventually overturned, got exiled in Cuba, was there for 4 years, organized the publication of the Crusader, a newspaper, a publication, and actually had Radio Free Dixie, okay, which he actually broadcast from Cuba, and so forth, calling on African Americans to engage in revolutionary struggles. This is a this is the gun he published, book published, Negroes with Guns. Okay, which frightened people. I mean, at the time, you know, this is all before the Black Panther Party, right? He's organizing. And in fact, there was an attack by Ku Klux Klan on one particular African-American activist. he organized guns. That attack never took place when they were shot back against. Okay, and this is him and his wife Mabel in arms training, gun shooting training in Cuba, and so on. He eventually left Cuba, and this will come back because it's an interesting point, and I'll come back to that. Over, he had a very good relationship with Fidel Castro, but there was an ideological or theoretical difference over the issue of race and class, and we'll come back to that later. So what I'd like to go into now, okay, is provide a short beginning history of Cuba, the whirlwind tour of Cuban history from 1490 to 1959, because I think it's important, right? Okay. Oh, and I forgot. Here's Assata Shakur. She is a prominent, she's most famous African-American political exile living in Cuba. This is the person who, when the Pope, the late Pope, Pope John Paul II, visited Cuba, a letter was written to him by the New Jersey governor trying to get her extradited and so forth. They put a bounty of over $1 million on her head. Okay. This is, I met her. I sent a photo I had with her. I talked to her about the situation and so forth. So she's actually the most famous African-American political exile in Cuba. I mean, there's a lot of Black Panthers who were there. William Brent wrote a book called Long Time Gone. There's a number of them who wrote about this experience. And there used to be so many of them that you actually have an African-American sort of community there as well, right? She's also a very important commentator on race relations in Cuba as well. And I may come back to her if we have the time. Okay. So I want to get into Cuban society, the destruction of indigenous. I think this is important to understand. And so the first thing, obviously, is Columbus arrives in 1492, and I won't get into the whole history of it. I actually teach a course in Cuban history. We have the complete, virtual, almost complete destruction of indigenous society. When he arrives in 1492, there's 112,000 people. By 1519, there's 19,000. By 1531, there's 7,000 left. And by the 1550s, there's less than 3,000 left. Okay, so they're completely wiped out. This will set the stage, obviously, for the voracious appetite and the massive importation of Africans from Africa. But before we proceed, I always like to pay credit to Hattuey. And Hattuey is extremely important because Hattuey is often seen by many as representing, you know, people resisted the colonial project, right? Resistance is recorded. But the first example of intellectual resistance, philosophical resistance, recorded example, I say, people talk about Hattuey. Hattuey lived in Haiti, was a cacique, i.e. sort of a leader, a chief in Haiti, a Taino chief. After the Spanish conquered Haiti, there's a whole history of the horrors of what the Spanish did in Haiti. He flees to Cuba to reorganize defense and so forth and so on. Eventually, he's captured by the Spanish and sent to be burnt to death. And when he's about to be burnt to death, be immolated, and there's a reason they burnt him to death, because in many of the Taino beliefs, before you could transit into the, you couldn't transit into the ancestor world if your body was burnt. So by burning your body, not only were they killing you, people were willing to give their lives, they were saying we were ending your complete existence, you could never join your ancestors and then interact with future generations. So this was to further terrorize people and not resist it. Anyway, as Hattuey is about to be immolated, to be burnt to death, a Spanish priest comes up to him and says, you know, tries to convert him. Do you want to convert to Christianity? And Hattuey says, why? I mean, there are different versions of the speech, of the, what was the exchange, and Hattuey says, why? The priest says, because there are lots, because don't you want to go to heaven? And Hattuey says, are there any Spaniards in heaven? Any Spanish people in heaven? The priest says, heaven is loaded with them. And Hattuey says, well, I'd rather go to hell, right? Okay? And so this is seen as a very profound form of resistance. This is him being burned. This is another representation. And this is a statue of Hattuey in Cuba. And in fact, many people remember, it no longer exists, there used to be a Hattuey beer, and so, which is very good. Better than the Cristal, I don't drink, but people told me so. Okay? So this sets the stage for the enslavement of Africans, and of course what sets the enslavement of Africans is the Atlantic Triangle. The Atlantic Triangle is a little more complicated than this, but this sets the basic matrix in which it occurs, which is the massive exploitation of African labor as unfree, okay, and the massive wealth that was made from it. And as we'll see, within all of this, in Cuba, sugar becomes enthroned, dripping with the blood of Africans. And so here we come, the enslavement of Africans. And 1511, first importation of enslaved Africans is recorded. In 1774, the African population is around 39,000. 1841, African population is over 400,000. And in 19th century, you see more than 600,000 imported. And one of the reasons that accounts for this dramatic increase is, if anyone knows the history, is in 1791, the Haitian Revolution occurs. Haiti, which was the most profitable European colony, has the Haitian Revolution. It was the largest sugar producer. And you have over 30,000 French planters fleeing from Haiti, arriving in Cuba and setting up shop. And therefore, Cuba suddenly takes off as this massive sugar producer. The sugar producer production increases massively. And in fact, it increases by over 40 to 50 times. And this leads to that one point where people often hear, where you have sin azúcar no hay país. Without sugar, there is no country, because sugar becomes king for a considerable period of Cuban history. Right now, it's no longer king, right? But the rhythms of Cuban life, a significant portion of Cuban life, and during the time of slavery, Cuban life was tied to that. So here we have the massive import of Africans, the free, the voracious appetite of the sugar plantations. And Africans resisted. So 1533 is the first recorded revolt at Jacobo Mines. Just examples of them. Enslaved Africans were decapitated, the violence, the heads displayed as a common practice on pikes and so forth, because you have to terrorize the population so that they don't revolt again. You have the example of Carlotta. She leads a rebellion in 1843. I actually have a picture of her later on. Carlotta actually becomes legendary because when Cuba launches its mission to defend Angola, its military mission to defend Angola from racist attack from South Africa, they named the mission Operation Carlotta, and so forth. And it's a famous essay. 1844, there's the famous La Escalera, where people actually were, after the revolt, the plan is, they call it La Escalera, the ladder, because people were tied to ladders and whipped and so forth, and executed, suppressed. 4,000 Africans, 300 free arrested, 200 tortured and killed. That's just an example. This is Carlotta, who planned the 1843 rebellion. There she is. And there's a statue of her in Cuba, breaking the chains and so forth. When you act back in this picture, you can actually see her breaking some chains here. So she becomes a symbol of resistance. And the point is, I wanted to demonstrate that Africans themselves were not helpless, hapless victims in Cuba, but were engaged in fighting for their freedoms. Now, this brings us to the next thing, which is the fact that simultaneously, along with this African resistance to slavery, to its brutality, organizing, you then begin to also have among the Spanish, who have become sort of the Creole class, who are therefore what they refer to as people, there used to be this division between those who were born there and the people who were born in Spain. Those who, it's very similar to what happened in the United States. Those who have now been born there and now identified with Cuba began to chafe under Spanish control. Taxation, the fact that they were excluded by the people who came directly from Spain, who referred to as the Peninsulares, from participating in control. So they feel themselves that they're excluded, and they begin to sort of chafe under this control, and you have various independence movements begin to take place. So, and you have some independence movements, organizations, even some rebellions taking place, and what happens is you have the African struggle for liberation, you have the Spanish, you have the Spanish Creole class that's there that's fighting for their independence. Okay, they're two separate strains of resistance. And then what happens is then this man, Carlos Manuel de Cespedes, on October 10th, 1868, calls his slaves together. It's called the Grito of Yara, or the Cry of Yara. Okay, says, listen, join me, I give you freedom, join me in a struggle for an independent Cuba, and so on. And that begins a 10 years war, from 1868 to 1878. And within that war, you have blacks participating, but one person rises particularly, and this is Antonio Maceo, often referred to as the Bronze Titan. He plays a very important role as a general. But what's interesting, he also suffers from some forms of racist prejudice and so forth, as we'll see. There's an argument he didn't receive some of the support he would have received and so forth. To cut a long story short, after 10 years, the war fails. And the question is, why did the 10 years war fail? And what's interesting is, sort of above a small thing, is that the war fails, there's sort of this fight for independence and so forth, the Spanish offer compromise and so forth, and Maceo refuses to compromise and so forth. And then we have the question, why did the 10 years war fail? Why did this 10 year struggle for independence fail and so forth? And one, people can argue lack of resources, failure to extend the war into the western provinces. It was primarily rooted in the east. The attempt to spread it into the west of Cuba failed for a number of reasons. U.S. opposition to Cuban independence. The United States feared a black republic. In some ways, the kind of fear that emerged after the Haitian Revolution gripped the Americans, right? And the U.S. feared another black republic and so forth emerging, right? And so on. And one important point are the racial tensions and lack of unity. and key, and this is Maceo, this is a statue of Maceo, you find them all over Cuba. But then one person emerges within Cuban history to play a very important role. His name is Jose Marti. And Jose Marti goes about analyzing why did the Cuban Revolution, why did the 10 Years War fail? And he begins to identify some very key aspects of this. And I recommend if anybody wants to know about the Cuban Revolution, but he wants to know about Cuba, you need to know about Jose Marti. He is central, right? And Jose Marti is central, and I recommend that you read a very good book on Jose Marti, probably the best book available in the English language by John Kirk, who's here. Jose Marti, Mentor of the Cuban Nation, and in fact, it's an updated version and it's been sold in the back there. So Jose Marti comes along, and I won't get into his history, but he develops a vision. Vision is of a free Cuba, necessity for political organization and unity, necessity for socioeconomic changes, particularly on the issue of race and social inequality. And I would argue that Jose Marti joined the national liberation struggle, rights for all, and Latin American unit into a single revolutionary stream. And he inveighed specifically against racial discrimination. I just want to read one particular quote here that I think really captures the impact of Jose Marti. Because he is famous for asserting, and this problem comes back problematically. Marti is famous, for example, for asserting that his argument was that independence could not be achieved, okay, unless all sectors of Cuban society were mobilized. Okay? And more importantly, what we also argued as well was that you had to have a social transformation. And some people often like to refer to it as the Revolutionary War, because it wasn't about national liberation. They were talking about some very fundamental social transformation. And so Marti is famous for actually asserting that Cubans were more than black or white. They, above all, were Cubans. And this played a very important role in fostering unity at that particular point. And we'll come back during the revolution. When it comes to the revolution, it then becomes a very interesting block and having a discussion about race relations. But we'll get back to that. This is what Marti emphatically stated. Quote, and this is him trying to challenge the racist prejudice against white Cubans who wanted to fight for independence but didn't want to accord blacks an equal place. Must we be afraid of the Cuban who has suffered the most from being deprived of his freedom in the country, where the blood he shed for it has made him love it too much to be a threat to it? Will we fear the Negro, the noble black man or black brother, who for the sake of the Cubans who died for him has granted eternal pardon to the Cubans who are still mistreating him? Well, I know of black hands that are plunged further into virtue than those of any white man I have ever met. From the Negro's love for reasonable freedom, I know that only in greater natural and useful intensity does his differ from the white man's love of freedom. I know that a black Cuban has drawn his noble body to its full height and become a solid column for his native liberties. Others may fear him. Anyone who speaks ill of him, I disown, and I say to him openly, you lie. And Marti himself, when he was building, lived most of his life outside of Cuba, when he was traveling, trying to build support, gather resources for the next wave of the Cuban national liberation struggle, He traveled and often stayed among Afro-Cuban communities that lived outside of Cuba. And quite often, Winston James, for example, in his seminal work, Holding Aloft the Banners of Ethiopia, okay, he described Jose Marti as probably the first truly anti-racist European in history, and so forth. To cut a long story short, Jose Marti then organizes, okay, and he's the chief intellectual author of what is referred to as a necessary war. This is a war for Cuban independence, raged from 1895 to 1898. Jose Marti is killed very early on. And in fact, I thought it was always appropriate to actually present what was actually an excerpt from his last letter. And where he declared, and Marti was killed very early on, that his aim was, quote, to prevent by the independence of Cuba, the United States from spreading over the West Indies and falling with an adequate upon the lands of our America. All I have done up to now and shall do hereafter is to that end. I have lived inside the monster and know his insides. And in fact, he also published an essay in Nuestra America, Our America, where Marti also argued in it for teaching history not from European conquest, but for beginning with First Nations history and so forth. So Marti was quite a profound thinker, especially even now, but especially given the time he lived in. And then we have the U.S. intervention in Cuba. The U.S. intervenes in 1898, what the Americans like to refer to as the Spanish-American War. It's as if there was no Cuban fight before that. And the U.S. intervenes for a number of reasons. Obviously, they want Cuba had obviously been a target that they wanted to acquire. That can be in discussion, why they wanted to acquire, what methods they went to. But also, you can actually read through the things. They were frightened that the Cubans would win independence, and you'd have this black mixed-race republic that would be sitting on its shores and so forth. So they intervened, and this is the kind of, false image of the Rough Riders of charging up San Juan Hill by Theodore Roosevelt. That never really happened. And so the U.S. intervenes. And what you find taking place in the intervention, okay, what's important to understand during the intervention is that during the war, before the intervention, during the war itself, Afro-Cubans, okay, had gained all sorts of prestigious posts, right? And in many cases made up more than one half of the army. And this raised hopes of social justice, political freedom, and racial inequality. However, with the U.S. intervention and occupation of Cuba, you have the dismantling of the provisional government, which had been set up by the freedom fighters, and you have the reversal of the advances and institutional gains that black Cubans had made. And you had all sorts of restrictions on blacks, social and political participation, was all constrained. And as we go through here, the impact of U.S. intervention on black Cubans, it's important to understand that this intervention, okay, provides a background to the Cuban Revolution, and the perception of U.S. domination and endemic corruption was a feature of the 1898-1959 period. And as I was talking about, here is what happens. The Liberation Army and the Provisional Government are dismantled. You have the military occupation of Cuba until May 20th, 1920, and you have many reversal, as I said before, of the gains made of the Cuban Revolution, of the necessary war, the 3-year war from 1895 to 1898, and many of, particularly the reversal of the gains made by African Cubans. You basically had an attempt to impose in Cuba the kind of segregationist and discriminatory policies that existed in the US South. And for example, in 1901 elections, the franchise explicitly excluded Cubans, women, and those with less than $250. So in the 3-year war from 1895 to 1898, more or less, you have sort of an empowerment of African Cubans who rise in the ranks, okay, and begin to have significant influence, make serious social advances. U.S. intervenes, and all of this is reversed. And then this sets the stage for a number of interesting events. Now, I'm just going to go past a lot of this stuff, but it's interesting to understand that African Cubans did not remain, okay, passive spectators in this whole event. They began to organize, and one of the important things they began to organize, the fight for their rights, is the Independent Party of Color that was organized in 1908. Eventually, it was banned by the Cuban government, which said made it illegal to have an organization, made it illegal for a party to be organized on the basis of race. These people were fighting, and they cast themselves in the vision and the ideas of José Martí, which is we call for equal rights for all Cubans, and we also believe that Cuba should have independence free from U.S. domination, which Cuba was completely dominated by the U.S., as we'll see, up until 1959. Anyway, they organize. They have there's an uprising that takes place, and what happens is this uprising is put down in 1912 with tremendous brutality. Some people estimate over 6,000 Cubans, African Cubans, black Cubans, were killed with the participation of the U.S. government and so forth. So this takes place, and in fact, this year is the 100th anniversary, and in fact, a special commission in the Cuban Communist Party to actually recognize and commemorate that massive massacre that took place. What I have up here is an image, because all sorts of racist images were used. The idea that to justify the massacres, that for example, the plan was that these black men planned to come and take white women and despoil them, all the negative, debased, vicious things that you associate with the worst of the US South in justifying the brutality and oppression of black people was used. And this is one of the offensive cartoons. There's a whole bunch of others that I found. I just wanted to use this one. Okay. And in this whole period, as we'll find, okay, what we find unfolding as well is that from 1898 to 1959, which is the basic domination of Cuba by the U.S., what we see faced is basically blacks face discrimination and marginalization, but despite this, they participated in worker struggles and participated in the great revolutionary upheavals, for example, of the 1930s, and that's, in 1930s, a revolutionary situation that emerged in Cuba during a mass upheaval against the Machado dictatorship. And sort of as an aside remark, it reached its apex in 1933. And what's interesting as U.S. ships came to stand off the harbor, because they were terrified that, one, the argument usually is they came there to protect what they, was American property. I think another argument that can be made is that in the height of the U.S. Depression, the example of a revolutionary Cuba would have had significant impact within the United States itself. Because, don't forget, communists were gaining allegiances, there were mass strikes, and don't forget that Douglas MacArthur was used around that time to crush the march, the Bonus Army in Washington to clear them out. But you had key players like this person I have up here, is Jesus Mendez. He was a key player in the union movement, okay? He's one of the key heroes in Cuba. You often see him at workers, on May Day when you have the workers' march. His photograph is often, portrait is often carried. He eventually was murdered and so forth. You also had, during the 1930s, a literary movement called the Negrista literary movement that emerged. And you had key people like Nicolas Guillén, who I'll quote from him later on. And the struggles of Africans for their rights, of black Cubans for their rights and so forth, actually resulted in the inclusion in the 1940 Cuban Constitution of Article 23, which prohibited racial discrimination. Nevertheless, despite these struggles, and despite that constitutional article, black Cubans were the most exploited and marginalized group in Cuban society, confined to the worst and lowest paying jobs. And during the 1956-59 revolutionary struggle, led, or War of National Liberation, led by Fidel Castro, black Cubans joined the movement, drawn to the movement's program that promised economic benefits for the lowest strata in society. And in the western part of Cuba, they were quite strongly represented in the revolutionary movement. And so here we have, for example, a key player. This is Juan Almeida Bosque. He was a key commander in the Cuban Revolution. This is him with Fidel Castro. You know that. This is him actually extolling and arguing with a visiting American intellectual, and actually think, or journalist, I actually think that may be Hubert Matthews. We won't get into that, okay? And this is one of the last photos of Juan Almeida before he died of a heart attack just recently and so forth. He was very much loved. He's a key leader, and as we'll see, while he may appear as a lone key leader, one of the things we'll come back is very interesting things are developing in Cuba right now in terms of the promotion of blacks to important powers. So we come to the Cuban Revolution. And two central preoccupations of the Cuban Revolutionary Movement. One, achieving social justice and establishing and affirming Cuban independence and sovereignty. And these two preoccupations were seen as interconnected. Okay? Now, before I get to that, okay? So what was Cuba before 1959? Okay? Now, if anyone looks at the stats pre-59, you get the idea that Cuba was in the upper tier of Latin America, contrasting sharply with most underdeveloped countries in the region. For example, in Latin America, Cuba ranked third in life expectancy, fourth in electricity consumption per capita, and fifth in per capita income, had one of the highest car ownership rates in the region. And so these figures indicate that Cuba is relatively well off. However, it is necessary to look further to disaggregate these figures and statistics. Hidden in these figures and statistics is a level of high inequality in Cuban society. The distribution of wealth and well-being was heavily skewed in favor of the rich and professional classes. And a 1951 World Bank study nonetheless stated, quote, there is a very wide gap between the income of a relatively few high-income receivers at the top and a mass of low-income receivers at the bottom. And underscoring all of this was a profound racial divide, with black Cubans at the bottom of all social wealth indicators. And all this was, for example, indicated particularly in the urban-rural divide. More than one quarter of Cuba's population were landless peasants, dependent on unstable seasonal employment, who lived a precarious existence. Land ownership was concentrated in a few large landowners. Many of them were U.S. companies. And the average pre-1959 peasant income was less than one-third of the national average. These figures, and I won't go over them, was also, in a sense, reflected in what happened in the urban area, right? And what you have taking place in Cuba are a number of profound transformations, okay? You have, for example, in March of 1959, you have prices for medicines reduced and you have rents lowered by 30% to 50%. In May of 1959, you have the first agrarian reform, which distributes land, actually fulfilling the article in 1940 Constitution. You have electricity rates in August of 1959, we decreased by 30%, and that sounds very interesting given the fact that electricity rates in Nova Scotia have gone up, okay? And there's a whole number of measures. In October 1960, you have the Urban Reform Law, and in 1961, you have the January Law. So while a lot of these themselves did not directly address the issue of race, because black Cubans were overwhelmingly represented in the poorest areas. They overwhelmingly benefited from these transformations as well. And also, at the same time, you had Fidel Castro and Che Guevara making statements that racial discrimination itself was unacceptable. And in fact, at one point, Che Guevara says, we have to paint the university black, red, all the colors of Cuban society, and so on. So there's this attempt, basically, to say that racism and social discrimination are completely antithetical to the Cuban Revolution. So Cuba challenges this marginalization and social exclusion in a social sphere that existed and set the pattern of black life until 1959. And so with all these transformations in health, housing, education, and so forth, these overwhelmingly benefited black Cubans. And in fact, you had a poll, for example, in 1959, 80% of black Cubans were in favor of the revolutions. And you had a whole number of very different things where I said Fidel Castro on several occasions spoke out against racism and so forth. The agrarian reform, the urban reform themselves played a very important role in redistributing wealth in the Cuban society. And racial discrimination was formally outlawed and enshrined in the Cuban constitution. And there's actually a very important statement by a black Cuban who experiences what I'd like to read. This is what he says at that time. Quote, okay, and he's working at a nickel refinery. I am most proud of what the revolution has done for the workers and the campesinos. Not only work, for example, not only at work. For example, Negroes couldn't go to a beach or to a good hotel or be bosses in industry or work in the railroads or in public transportation in Santiago. This was because of their color. They couldn't go to school or be in a political office or have a good position in the economy either. They would run in the streets without bread. They went out to look for work and couldn't get it. But not now. All of us were equal. The white, the Negro, the mulatto. And there's several quotes from that. For example, there's a very good book I recommend called Four Men, Living the Revolution, Oral History of Contemporary Cuba. And there's all sorts of statements by black Cubans about the transformation of their life and so forth. And also, within Cuba, it was interesting, they developed a discussion on the necessity to develop a non-racist historiography of Cuba that basically also included black Cubans. And I found this example here. This is produced by the Casa de las Americas. It's called Africa in America, and it came out in the early 1960s and so on. An example of this attempt, though small, though inadequate, to address the kind of racist historiography or exclusionary historiography or narrative that existed. And perhaps the most dramatic statement about how the lives of black Cubans were affected in the early years of the revolution comes from Nicolas Guillén, who is considered Cuba's poet laureate. So I have being black, I can be stopped by no one at the door of a dancing hall or bar. I have let see that I have learned to read, to count. I have that I have learned to write and to think and to laugh. I have that now I have a place to work and earn what I have to eat. I have let see what I have coming to me. That became a very important poem and so forth. But what happened, what's very interesting, is that despite these tremendous social advances, and we can see them here reflected in the this is a graph comparing illiteracy rates between Cuba, Latin America, and the Caribbean and the United States, infant mortality rate and physicians and life expectancy, you see Cuba compares very well. But despite this, racism still continued to exist in Cuba. Okay? Despite this, the gap between blacks and whites had not been transformed, right? Okay? And the question is, why did this exist? Okay? Why do these things continue to exist, right? One argument is that 30 years, which is when we look up to 1989, is too short a time in which to completely transform what was created in over in nearly 500 years of slavery and colonial domination. The second point is also Cuba was a small, undeveloped nation, for example, who had objective limitations on what it could transform in terms of the material conditions. An example is housing. Anyone who's been to Cuba knows that Cuba has poor housing stock. And one thing that stands up is black Cubans tend to live in the poorest housing stock than white Cubans. And what's interesting, though, is that at the beginning of the 1960s, the Cuban government launched a very ambitious housing and building project, right? They were going to transform all the housing stuff. And there was a time when Fidel Castro was pouring over some housing, new housing plans. And Che Guevara said, those look pretty exorbitant. You know, can we afford this? And Fidel says, listen, we made a revolution so all Cubans could live like this. And then Cuba ran into the objective constraints. They couldn't have universal health care. They couldn't defend the country. They couldn't build a universal education system. And at the same time, do everything they wanted. So they had to raise in the material transformation of Cuban society. And at the same time, they faced the siege of the U.S. Imperialism, which put all sorts of serious limitations on what Cuba could do and so forth. But there was also a very important factor, the failure of the Cuban government to appreciate and address the complexity of the situation of African Cubans, and that dealing with the legacy of the past necessitated active and direct participation intervention in the state in all spheres of society. Okay? Now, remember, for example, that I mentioned that we had Robert Williams, right, who left Cuba after 4 years. He had a huge debate, okay, with the Cubans over the fact that that race should not be seen as epiphenomenal, right, and racial discrimination should not be seen as subsidiary to class society and so on. And he left over that debate. And the Cubans always, there was a lack of discussion over race relations. In fact, there was a book that was published called The Definitive Solution to the Black Problem in Cuba that said racism didn't exist anymore, racial inequality was a phantasm of the past and so forth. And what happened at that time was that, basically speaking, people thought that race itself and racism and racial inequality would necessarily disappear as if one dealt simply through the prism of class and so forth. And then once the class issue was resolved, race itself and racial discrimination would naturally disappear. Okay? So in this dogmatic position in which race was subordinate to class and that the idea that racism would inevitably win their way, Fidel Castro intervenes. And in 1986, at the Third Congress of the Communist Party of Cuba, Fidel Castro said, racism hasn't disappeared in Cuban society. We must intervene directly to deal with it. And in 1986, they instituted an affirmative action program to promote more blacks and women and youth into positions of influence and into positions of status and power in the Cuban Revolution and in the Cuban Communist Party, and so on. And so this became a very significant measure. And this affirmative action program has been reaffirmed at every party congress and in between. And in fact, at the last Congress Party of the Communist Party, of the Communist Party of Cuba in 2011, it was actually reaffirmed again. And I'm going to come back to that in a second. Okay? So then we come to why did I stop at 1989? Okay? Well, in 1989, we have the beginning of the disintegration of the East Bloc. And Cuba goes into a huge economic crisis. Some of you are probably familiar with it. But the economy, they lose 85% of their trade. The economy contracts by 35%. At some stages, 60% of the factories close. And Cubans begin to suffer, in some cases, from malnutrition. The average Cuban lost 20 to 25 pounds. And the economy was in a tremendous straits. And in fact, it's described as the largest decline of an economy in peacetime, even greater than that of the special period. And in order to get out of that, the Cubans launched a number of, why has the electronics failed me? Okay, let's see. From current slide. There we go. So a number of economic measures. And I'm going to focus on three of them. The establishment of self-employment and small private enterprise, legalization of possession of foreign currency, especially US dollars, and a large-scale development of tourism and foreign investment and joint ventures. And these all had a major impact on equality in Cuba. Remittances, for example, remittances is money people send abroad from abroad to their families. It happens all through the third world and so forth. And in Cuba, it began to have a significant impact. In the early 1960s, when Cuba began to have these radical social transformations, the land reform, the urban reform, and so forth, you had a mass exodus of around 200,000 to 250,000 Cubans. These were upper middle class professionals and so forth. And this had opened up a space that black Cubans could move into. Okay, because one of the reasons they were able to move into professions and so forth was not only also because of the policies of the Cuban Revolution, but also because there was a space that had been created by these people who had left. But what happened is the majority of people who had left, the vast majority who had left, were white. So then when they were sending money back home, it was going to their white relatives and families. And so this created a very significant source of inequality, particularly when the Soviet Union collapsed. And Cuba now had to integrate itself into the world capitalist economy. And in a 2000 survey of Havana, found that 34% of Cuban households received remittances. However, the rate was 44% for white households and only 23% for black households. And in 1996-2002 study by the Center for Anthropology concluded that whites had a 2.4 greater chance of receiving remittances than blacks. And this all led it to began to see a thing growing into inequality. Blacks tend to live in the worst housing and most overcrowded neighborhoods. This is important because when Cuba opened in self-employment and people could rent out homes to tourists, one of the important things, if you lived in the worst housing, you had less opportunity to fix in terms of having something that was going to be attractive. If you received remittances, you could fix up your place as well, right, and rent out to tourists and so forth. You had private restaurants called paladares opening up, okay? You needed money to be able to do all these things. You needed to be in a good house, and you also needed to have the money to fix all of these things up as well. So all of these things became very important. And what we began to see, okay, is that blacks, for example, became overrepresented in the state sector. One study indicated that 70% of whites work in the state sector, that's supposed to be state, not state sector, are composed compared to 84% of blacks, and three times as many whites as blacks work in the self-employed sector. I mean, the self-employed sector, when you all go, people have been to Cuba, and you see, you go to these restaurants, you see all the self-employed activity in Cuba. Overwhelmingly, it's whites participating in it. And why are they participating in it? Because they have the capital wherewithal to do that. Okay. And you also began to see this happening as well. One of the things that happened in terms of tourism, for example, was that Cuba, facing this massive economic crisis, having no natural resources, perhaps they will discover oil, they're exploring it right now, but having no natural resources, went straight into tourism. And while they were building all of the infrastructure, in order to access the markets, they often contracted out the management and so forth of these hotels to European companies. And what would often happen is European companies would come in, bring in their own particular, we would argue, racist practices, and in many cases, they would fire people en masse. Okay? And often, you'd only see the people who would be hired would be white Cubans working, because these were thought to be, one, more acceptable to tourists and so forth. Black Cubans would often be doing the menial work, what we'd often refer to as the shit work, and so forth. This became one of the major things in Cuba. And tourism was also, because you're meeting with tourists, it was a way you could get tips, access to hard currency and so forth. And what people did with that hard currency was obviously they poured back into maybe other self-employment activity of other people and so forth. So you began to have this cycle taking place. And what you began to see here, for example, okay, was growing inequality. So in the top tier of income, only 6% of blacks represented compared to 11% of whites. The lowest income tier, 30% of blacks, 30%, 27% of whites. And the average difference between the highest and lowest income earner was 30-1. And, oops, that's in 19, and this is important because in the 1980s, it was 4.5-1. Now, while this may seem to be low compared to Latin American standards, it's high by Cuban standards, right? Very appreciably high and so forth, right? And you have some people, for example, who are working in these private restaurants and renting rooms where the average I gave you was 30-1. But in some cases, it can be as high as 10,000 to 12,000-1 and so forth, because they have the capacity to invest in all of these different things. You find black Cubans overwhelmingly overrepresented in the state sector, which before the economic crisis actually was not a bad place to work. But when you began to have self-employment open up and its ability to acquire a significant amount of hard currency and so forth, that then began to see tremendous amounts of, for example, inequality began to emerge and so forth. Now what I have up here is a picture which is common to a lot of people of police officers asking black Cubans for their identity card, the CONET, right? And what you began seeing emerge, and I'm going to read a very interesting part here, what you also began seeing emerging in Cuba was that prior to 1989, prior to these changes, okay, not only did you see from 1959 to 1989 a significant narrowing of the material gap between black and white Cubans, okay, not completely closed, but significant narrowing, you also, in Cuba, became impermissible to actually say racist things in public, in the public sphere. And I'll actually read a story that indicates that. That's really, it's by Janetta Cole, some of you may know her. She basically teaches at Emory University, and she recounts this particular story, which I think is pretty powerful. And this is what she says. This is when she was in Cuba. This is all before the economic crisis of the 1990s. I was traveling on a very crowded bus. At a bus stop where many people got off, a black man got a seat. A middle-aged woman said in a very loud and irritated voice, "And it had to be a black who gets the seat." The response of the people on the bus was incredible. people began to criticize the woman, telling her that the revolution was fought to get rid of these stupid ideas, that the black man should be viewed as having the same rights as she had, including a seat on a crowded bus. The discussion and the criticism became loud and animated. The bus driver was asked to stop the bus because the people engaging in the criticism had declared that the woman expressing racist attitudes must get off the bus. For the rest of my trip, the people apologized to their black comrade and talked about where such racist ideas come from and what must be done to get rid of them. So that's an example of how, one, it not only become impermissible to express those ideas in the public sphere, but people also felt honor-bound, in a sense, socially duty-bound, to actually intervene when they occurred. What we began to see with the material changes in Cuban society, the introduction of these policies which created this basis for inequality, what we began to see unfold in Cuba, okay, was the return of these racist ideas. And people now because the hard currency, access to hard currency, which at first was the US dollar, which circulated legally, now we have a proxy called the Cuban convertible peso, but access to that became very important, right? So in the rush for dollars, okay, what happened is that you had quote-unquote legal means to obtain it, and you had people who hustled and so forth, right? And so blacks now increasingly became identified with criminal activity. Criminogenic theses began to emerge. People began to utter these kind of things that black people are inherently more criminal and so on. And that became part and parcel of a resurgence in Cuba of these ideas and so forth. And this became very difficult. So what did the Cuban government do? Did it remain passive in all of these different things? And what actually happened is the Cuban government, after the revolution, after the economy had stabilized, began to do a number of different things as well. And one of the examples that happened was that they began to actually challenge some of the racist practices of these hotels. So for example, there were two cases, and I'll just focus on one. In one case, a very famous hotel, it was Havana Libre, the Spanish came in, and what they did, they fired most of the black staff, fired over 1,000 people, and got rid of them, right? And people launched a complaint through the Cuban Central Workers Organization, and they won the complaint, the workers reinstated, and the contract was voided. There's another hotel in Old Havana that was actually went through the same similar situation and so forth. And what's actually happening, and this is a thing I do with my friend, Professor Keith Ellis, who's another Cuba specialist, is sometimes when we're in Cuba together, we make a practice of actually traveling from hotel to hotel and counting the black faces, okay, in managerial positions. And one of the things we found that in the state hotels, because some of these hotels are returning to state management, because they were these management contracts in some of these places were time honored, you actually see greater number of black faces in control. Those hotels that tend to be controlled by the foreign companies, right? Okay, managed by the foreign companies, tend to have less black faces, right? And have them, if they're there, to be in menial positions and so forth. So the state began to tackle some of these issues and began to openly talk about racial discrimination, the harassment and so forth that was taking place. And what's unfolded in Cuba is, for example, a massive debate has emerged. And you have all sorts of conferences that are taking place now, challenging, racist discrimination in Cuba, calling for significant policies to deal with it, and also having an intellectual level, historians and philosophers coming together and actually arguing, right, that while people often focus on the sources of the Cuban revolutionary movement as being the ideas of José Martí, the ideas, for example, of stemming from the African liberation struggles against slavery are just as critically important. This here, for example, is a good friend of mine, Samuel Fourier is actually one of the a very significant scholar. I mean, who knows him. He's written a very good book on Rastas in Cuba, and so on. And there's a whole slew. And in fact, I know Rocky will be going to a conference. And it's strange, in Canada, you know, it's so hard to organize stuff on Black Canadian Studies, but there's actually a conference on Black Canadian Studies taking place in Cuba and Matanzas in February and so forth. And on several occasions, Fidel Castro himself, and there's a lengthy quote I have here, I won't go into it, talked about the fact that racial discrimination has not been eliminated in Cuba, and the Cuban government hasn't done enough to actually deal with this and so forth. So there's a vibrant debate taking place in Cuba, and it's unfolding, and and what you see as well, which is very important to bear in mind in Cuba as well, is I mentioned those affirmative action policies, right? You find, for example, that black Cubans have moved into very important positions in the governing structure of Cuba, particularly in the Communist Party. This is a picture of him. We had a meeting of one of the guys who was running one of the local communist branches. But here is a picture of the Council of State. These are members of the Cuban Council of State. The Council of State is like Cuba's highest cabinet. And you see the number of black faces phenotypically black faces increased significantly. And in fact, in the where most of the next leadership is going to come from is actually going to come from the leaders of the provincial parties, and most of the leaders of the provincial branches of the party are black, and so forth. So there's a significant promotion of black faces, of black Cubans, into political power, into Cuba. What's interesting, though, is Cuba is very unusual. The people who have the most economic wherewithal and financial resources, who are the self-employed workers renting out rooms, who are running these private restaurants, who engage in other activity and so forth, tend to be white, okay? But they have the least political influence in Cuba, direct political influence. So in many ways, you have a very strange situation. In our case, we're used to political, economic power and wherewithal being able to buy and control political influence. In Cuba, that doesn't exist. But this creates a contradiction, right? Because as inequality emerges in Cuba, okay, and the attempts are put in place to put policies to deal with it, okay, and you have blacks being promoted into positions of political power, it creates a very interesting dynamic and so forth. There have been a number of other affirmative action policies. For example, they directed a number of education policies specifically at communities where they know the black population is most represented. Now, in conclusion, what I would like to say is, how does this all mean? What does this all mean for us, right? Okay. What does it mean for living in North America? And I think Cuba offers some very interesting lessons. Okay. With the introduction from 1959 to 1989, Cuba basically had, with its twists and turns, socialist development, anti-capitalist development. But with the introduction of capitalist elements and concessions since the 1990s, they've created a material basis that has challenged equality within Cuban society, particularly racial equality. These inequalities cannot be compared with those that prevail globally, but they are significant by Cuban standards. Despite the travails of the 1990s, Cuba continues to be characterized as a society with the least inequality and equity and the most equality and equity. But there are lessons to be learned. First is that, one, I would think that judging and tentative lessons to be judged is that when one looks at the 1959 to 1989 30-year period, what we see with a basically socialist development is a general erosion and advances against racial inequality. What we also learn, however, is that it is not not sufficient by itself, because it doesn't directly deal with race itself. So race itself is not epiphenomenal, and therefore you must have direct intervention in the question of race as well. What we also learn, I think, after what happened in the 1990s, with the introduction of capitalist elements, is that this tendency and the forces towards equality within Cuban society become overwhelmed by the fact that you have these capitalist measures being introduced and so forth. And these capitalist measures, by their necessity, generate inequality. So one of the things I would argue is that, one, that I think comes from the Cuban struggle, is, one, the necessity for socialism as being a necessary but not sufficient condition to generate equality. Two, the necessity that one must intervene directly on the question of race. And three, that capitalism by its very nature, right, as in the case study of Cuba, does not generate equality, but by its nature generates inequality. And fourth, the last conclusion, is because Cuba is a small, poor, undeveloped country living in a capitalist world economy, there are limits to what it can do. It has made significant advances, but ultimately it falls prey in many cases to the dynamics of the world capitalist economy, which probably means that an ultimately anti-racist Cuban society, where African Cubans, both materially and in terms of their spiritual and psychological life, can achieve the kind of equality, equity, and dignity that we all dream of, must wait, for example, on probably a global transformation of the world. At the same time, it's important to understand that among the strongest supporters of the Cuban Revolution are black Cubans, because they have gained tremendously from the Cuban Revolution, and they also understand that the revolution was to be overthrown, that people most likely to return to power in Cuba would be the Cuban Miami exiles, who have tremendous racist palates, and they themselves would probably reimpose the kind of gross inequality that existed before 1959. So in many ways, as one black Cuban says, the issue and debate in Cuba is about how much the revolution has done for us, but how much more we needed to do for us, and how we can fight within the revolution to extend these gains. So I know I've gone on for quite a period of time, well, just about an hour or so, but thank you, and I hope we can have a very interesting exchange of ideas. Thank you. Before I go, I just want to actually show one thing I forgot about. This is a current debate that was that's taking place in Cuba. It's called, it's a sort of like a forum, Racism in Cuba. The debate comes into the light. These are some of the questions. Does racism still exist in Cuba? This is actually taking place in 2012. What groups are most affected by this discrimination? And this is organized within Cuban society. Is a problem only for those affected and so forth, who should be involved in that fight? And what I wanted to add is that Cuba, while these inequalities I spoke about are large by Cuban standards, right? Okay. They're small by Latin American standards. But they have assumed very important dynamics in Cuban society. And Cuba is still an example, and so this is a sign that says, in the absurd first world, you know, it consumes 3/4 of what is produced. Okay. And this was a sign I always liked. This was a sign in Cuba was based on the words of a former vice president of Cuba. And it basically says 200 million children sleep in a 200 million of the world's children sleep in the streets today. Not one of them is Cuban. Mm. So while Cuba faces all of these problems I outlined, one of the things we're going to say that Cuba does not suffer from are the endemic problems that exist throughout Latin America. And despite the problems of trying to overcome racial inequality in a permanent way, Black Cubans don't want to lose these gains. And so one can, and this is one of the things I forgot to mention as well, I'm sorry, but one of the things I should mention is that for a lot in the Cuba solidarity movement, right, people who support Cuba, the issue of race was a non-issue, right? Now, when I raised the issue of race in my book, that chapter, Race, Inequality, and Revolution, that's the third chapter in the book, it came out of a paper I delivered at the University of Havana. It was very controversial. I was attacked by Cuban scholars who were both black and white and defended by Cuban scholars who were black and white and so forth. And many in the Cuba solidarity movement who support the Cuban Revolution thought it was sort of betraying the Cuban Revolution not to raise the issue of race. I believe you can support the Cuban Revolution as I do. I'm a complete supporter of the Cuban Revolution and engage in Cuban solidarity activity. But you can also raise these critical issues because race is a critical issue and the Cubans themselves are raising it both from the top leadership and from the bottom of society. Thank you.